This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international programme of the non-profit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Robert Picardo, the emergency medical hologram from Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, are...
Suzanne Williamson and...
Kay Shaw.
Well, today, we are going to be talking about drones. And not just any drone, one drone in particular. And not just any one drone named One.
One is the loneliest number.
The loneliest Borg?
Oh, he's not lonely. He's got seven.
And Neelix.
Yeah, but... I don't remember Neelix being a Borg, and now that's giving me weird mental images. Borg Neelix.
No, but he's not alone because Neelix is his friend.
Oh, why did we never get Borg Neelix? That's where I've gone with that now.
Yeah, we got Borg Tuvok.
Yes.
Borg Neelix would
Borg
have been awesome.
Janeway and Borg B'Elanna, but we didn't get Borg Neelix.
Yeah, I would have rather have had Borg Neelix than Klingon Neelix.
Yes.
So we planned this episode out a couple weeks ago, and I honestly already can't remember which one of you wanted to talk about drones.
Suzanne.
It was me.
It was Suzanne.
It's one of my favorite episodes.
You know, it's funny you say that, because for me, it's an episode for years and years I would have said, I can't stand this episode. It's just boring. Okay, the 29th century Borg, I get it. It's a moral dilemma. I get it. It's run of the mill. But what I've come to realize is how brilliant the dialogue actually is in this episode. There are so many good lines in this episode.
And it makes me cry every time.
Yeah.
Really? See, I don't cry in Voyager. I tell you, I don't cry in Voyager.
You have no heart, Zachary.
We've had this conversation about how you're cold and dead inside.
No, it's funny because I was actually watching an episode of Stargate the other day, and I did kind of tear up at an episode, but
dude,
I've never cried about Voyager, but I just cried about Stargate the other
you
day.
You cried about Stargate, but you didn't cry about Voyager.
Yeah, there's no crying. There's no crying in the Delta Quadrant, but you can cry in a wormhole.
You didn't cry over Tuvix? Nothing?
Take the Delta Flyer and go.
No. He doesn't get the Delta Flyer. He gets one of the piddly shuttles that Chakotay crashed.
The Class 2 shuttles? No, the Class 2 shuttles, right?
Yes.
The cramped ones?
But only one that Chakotay has ruined.
He could have the Delta Flyer Mark 1.
Doesn't that get blown up?
Yeah. But all those shuttles that Chakotay crashed get blown up as well.
That's true.
He can have the pieces in a bag to reassemble.
Yeah.
So, Suzanne, I want to know what you like about this episode. Do you like the comedy in this episode? It makes you cry, so is that why you like the episode? What in particular?
It does make me cry. It's very touching. I like the comedy. It's just, as a whole, the episode just works for me. And there's a baby crying in the background. But it's not a Borg baby.
You got a Borg baby over there, Suzanne?
Well, you know.
Something you want to tell us?
Yeah, there was a transporter accident.
I had a little problem with Logan this week, and yeah.
So, okay, you mentioned the transporter accident. Something has always bugged me about this episode, and I rewatched the episode today before we recorded, and it still bugs me. The thing that bugs me is when the mobile emitter gets Borgified and the little tubules come shooting out of it. Uh-huh. Where the hell does the extra matter come from that makes these tubules? Like, how can Borg stuff make stuff out
nanoprobes.
Of nanoprobes? It's like, how can the nanoprobes just make matter out of nothing?
They can replicate, can't
they? They can do anything.
How can they replicate? Where's the stuff coming from?
Well, yeah, but when they, like, assimilate someone, they make tubules and implants.
Right, but where does it all come from?
The nanoprobes make it out of stuff. They're like mini replicators.
Like what kind of stuff? They're not mini replicators.
They are.
They make
it out of like
random stuff that's like floating around. I could get all sciencey now and use terms like free radicals. Ooh.
Science the science.
Wait. In your head canon, nanoprobes are mini replicators.
They just make stuff out
of
whatever's there.
Yeah, and
but there's nothing there in the mobile emitter, right? How does it make this giant tubules that come shooting out of the mobile emitter?
How do you know that the bottom of the mobile emitter didn't like suck matter from the panel it was sitting on to make the tubules? It like from osmosis or something.
Osmosis.
I just wanted to say osmosis.
It seems like there's a difference in scale. Like these tiny little nanoprobes in this tiny little mobile emitter managed to make not only tubules, but an entire Borg.
No, it didn't make an entire Borg. It used the DNA template.
From Mulcahy.
And then it, like, you saw what it did to the console. It like made the console into like a
So you're saying that as the tubules shoot out of the mobile emitter, the mobile emitter itself gets consumed in some way, and the matter that makes up that mobile emitter is now tubule, and there's less mobile emitter there than there was before the tubules.
No, it's replicating the plating of the mobile emitter, what it's made out of.
Right.
It's reading that.
But what's it replicating from?
Like,
does it air? Where does the energy come from?
Atoms.
Yeah.
Atoms?
How do you usually replicate things? Janeway goes up to the replicator, says coffee, and it makes coffee.
Don't they have like a deuterium tank somewhere and the matter from the deuterium tank gets, you know, fused together into heavy elements and turned into replicated stuff?
Who wants to drink deuterium?
I have a deuterium gin fizz, please.
It's just like out of the air and stuff. It like sucks in air and makes it into tubules.
Are you sure? Are you making this up as you go?
Yes.
You know what you're talking
about. Of course I'm making this up as I go along.
Just like the writers did.
Just like the writers did. Zach, stop trying to make it make sense.
So visually, this doesn't bother you?
No.
This is like...
Not at all.
All of a sudden, there's boom, all this stuff shooting out of the... Like, where did all this matter come from? No?
It doesn't make sense.
It's just me.
No, it doesn't. But it doesn't bother me.
I want it to make sense, darn it. That's always bother... It's a little thing, but it's always just bugged me. It's like a tiny little plot hole.
Let it go.
Yeah, but we could confront you with a list of like 76,000 other things that happen during the course of Star Trek that equally don't make sense.
Yes.
I know, but I kind of want to obsess about those sometimes.
Well, don't.
Just let it go.
Just let it go.
Let it go.
But that issue aside, there's some awesome stuff inside this episode. I love Seven of Nine practicing her smile in the mirror at the beginning of the episode. That is brilliant.
I love the Doctor catching her do it.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, that, and I love how he checks himself out in the mirror, like, oh, a nice looking hologram.
I love how she gets all upset when he walks in, like she's embarrassed that he might have spotted her doing it. And then she's like, oh, I'm not quite sure whether he saw me or not. And then later on, when he's saying about taking the picture, he says, oh, go on, smile.
I know you can.
And then she realizes that he saw her and she's like,
It's kind of a long setup, actually.
Yeah, it is.
You have to wait a while for that.
In all honesty, he should knock before he goes in. That's her quarters.
It is. It's like walking in somebody's quarters, isn't it?
Well, he just walked into Bonna's shower virtually.
Yeah, that's true.
He did.
Hashtag no boundaries.
Yes, and then he did a McCoy, I'm a doctor, not a
doctor,
lawyer.
Doctor, not a peeping Tom.
Peeping Tom.
Which made me think, is Tom really a peeper?
Maybe
these are questions that I ask.
Did she hang up on him while she was in the bathroom? Did I remember this correctly? Like she's in the shower?
She threw the towel on it.
Oh, that's right. She hangs up on him and then she goes in the bathroom and then she throws the towel.
Yeah.
Right.
She stops talking to him and he goes away. And then when she's in the shower, he like pops back up on the monitor and that's when she's like, hey, and gets the towel.
I know I just rewatched this, but I couldn't get the order of operations right. That's a great line though. I'm a doctor, not a peeping Tom. Yeah. Nothing I haven't seen before.
Yeah.
Half Klingon or not.
I loved how that got reused in Voyager from McCoy.
Well, the Doctor does that quite a bit, actually. He's always dropping
the
McCoy lines.
I think he does more of them than McCoy did.
He used that in his audition, too.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. Easy sell.
I'm a doctor, not a peeping Tom.
That's the key right there. Okay, you listeners out there, if you ever want to be on Star Trek and you want to be a doctor on Star Trek, that's the ticket right there. Drop a, I'm a doctor, not a fill in the blank.
I always assumed that the reason for that was because obviously he's programmed with all of the knowledge and like experiences of all the best docs in Starfleet, so he's got McCoy in there. That's what I always assumed.
And McCoy's front and center?
Yeah.
Wait, you're saying that somehow buried in McCoy's logs are a bunch of quotes of McCoy saying, I'm a doctor, not a blank.
I can see him keeping track of those. I'm a doctor, not a physicist.
Yeah.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
He's like, I'm so annoyed at Jim this week. He's like a slave driver. I'm a doctor, not a worker bee.
Well, yeah. I don't know whether it's done with like just their logs, is it? Or is he actually programmed?
I don't know.
The personality part of it as well. I don't know. Anyway, I always assumed that there's a bit of McCoy in there and that's why he does it. That's my headcanon anyway.
I like that.
Sure, that works. Are you watching the same Star Trek I'm watching? Because you seem to have some weird things in your headcanon.
But my headcanon's my headcanon. You don't want to come in here.
I like Kay's headcanon.
Oh, I do too. It's just different from mine. It's interesting.
Yeah. You never really thought, oh, he does that because he's got a bit of McCoy going on.
He does have a bit of McCoy going on. I don't know where, I never thought about it, right, honestly. Enough. Like, why does he drop the McCoy lines? I have no idea.
That's just kind of how I think I made sense of it.
Is it just a little bit of hero worship?
It's an homage, I would say.
It is definitely an homage from a writer's standpoint.
You can imagine that if there is some McCoy in there, he'd be, as you put it, front and center. He'd be like, hey! I'm surprised we didn't get some transporter comments as well.
Back to the doctor in the shower thing, because it's funny that Blana's reaction, she's annoyed, but she doesn't go all Klingon. She just, like, rolls her eyes at him and throws the towel, and she kind of complains at him a little bit, but she's not, like, throwing things at the screen. She doesn't go all Klingon.
No.
Which she should, because it's her only day to sleep in, and I go pretty ballistic when people don't let me sleep in.
That's what I'm saying. Why doesn't she go more Klingon?
Yeah, I thought that was pretty harsh of him to just not care. About the fact that it was a lion.
But can you imagine, like, being threatened with being stuck in sickbay again after you've gotten so used to being out and about and functioning with the rest of the crew, and all of a sudden you'd be confined in sickbay again? That'd be terrible. Yeah. It's like torture.
Early bird gets the gough.
That made me giggle.
Okay. Now, that is a very clever line. Early bird gets the gawk. You know, whoever wrote that just hit a home run with that line.
Yeah, that one makes me giggle.
That's what I'm saying. There are a lot of great one-liners in this episode. I'd kind of forgotten that.
Yeah. But I do get what you're saying. Like, I understand why he's feeling that way. He's obviously feeling a bit stir-crazy, like trapped. Like, he's got used to being able to move around and then suddenly he can't anymore. So I do get that, yeah. I'm probably jumping ahead here slightly, but...
Well, I was going to jump back for a second with a one-liner.
We have a plan? That's awesome.
I was going to talk about how we don't actually find out about whether they managed to make his mobile emitter back into a mobile emitter, but we can always talk about that later.
How do they? Let's talk. No, we should talk about that. We've already talked about the mobile emitter.
And they don't cover that. And then I don't actually really remember, but I assume in the next episode he's just got it back.
Yeah, they just sort of dig it out of one's head, I'm guessing.
Out of his cerebral cortex?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, so Seven's all devastated that he's died, and then suddenly they're like, oh, hang on a minute, let's just whop this out and, like, dust it off.
No, but the doctor's going to do an autopsy anyway.
That's true.
So he's got to take the brain out, so while he's in there, thank you, mobile emitter, back on my sleeve.
Maybe it was like a fetal transplant. They just transported it out.
Stop rubbing in the fetal transplant. Still upset about that.
No, I think that's one of the coolest things they ever did in Voyager. It's so weird. And maybe they just did the same trick with the mobile emitter. Just transported out of the cerebral cortex.
Yeah. But surely they had to, like, fix it. Because B'Elanna was talking about having to fix it
before. Yeah, circuits were fused.
Yeah.
But it's been Borgified. Okay, wait. If it becomes again, I want to delve into this because it's interesting to me and it doesn't make sense. So if it takes nanoprobes to Borgify the thing, do they have like anti-nanoprobes that de-Borgify?
No,
like,
just how more nanoprobes. Work? You program them differently.
Program them differently, yeah.
So Seven had to take some of her nanoprobes, reprogram to de-Borgify, inject them into the mobile emitter, and that's how the doctor got his mobile emitter back?
There you go.
But that doesn't sound simple. That sounds like that would have taken a while.
But Seven's involved, so it would go quickly.
Well, I don't know. The thing Borgify is overnight, right?
Can you just imagine that? Right, I'm imagining this now. So, you know how he says to B'Elanna at one stage, oh, why can't you be doing it here where I can, like, you know, see what's going on and stuff and, like, be involved in trying to fix it? So He insists on that. So basically, you've got B'Elanna and Seven in sickbay fixing the mobile emitter for some number of days whilst the doctor's going stir crazy and they're all practically about to kill each other.
Looking over their shoulder.
But why is it so much slower to deborgify it? Because it gets borgified like overnight.
Like, it's all got changed and fused and
integrated.
Yeah, it's a very delicate procedure.
I still say he cuts it out of the brain and slaps it on his shoulder and it's fine.
The whole idea that you can grow an entire new Borg from a single Borg nanoprobe is such a cool idea.
Yeah.
But you need the human DNA. You got to have some of Mulcahy in there.
The nanoprobe goes out and finds what it needs to make a new Borg.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the sperm tracking down the egg.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm doing my... I'm doing the doctor's dance.
Fortress ovum! Because obviously there's something in the 29th century technology that lets the nanoprobes and the DNA kind of do the baby-making thing, right? And I don't really get how that bit works either, to be honest.
The nanoprobes and the DNA do the horizontal mambo.
Yes.
Yeah.
They get it on.
But that's not how Borg normally reproduce, as Seven said. So obviously something about this tech. I'm like, what does that say about the mobile emitter?
Well, there's also some of the transporter in there because he has his own internal transporters.
True.
So that could have played a part in something.
Yeah, maybe.
Somewhere.
Yeah, they don't really make much. It's kind of cool that this Borg has his own little personal transporter so he can transport himself wherever he needs to be. But they don't really make too much of a thing of it. It's kind of a cool idea, though. I wish I had one.
Yes. That it is very cool. Especially the bit at the end where they're like, oh, we'll get you over there. And then he's like, it's fine. Ping. I'm on it.
I'm on it. Two steps ahead of you.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I don't want to make too much of this technology not making sense, but it's very hand-wavy. Much more than Voyager usually is.
Yeah. Oh, sure. But the bit at the beginning where it manages to produce the tubules bothered me less than the stuff that happened later.
No. Every time I see the tubule shoot out, I'm just like, oh my god. No, they didn't just make tubules shoot out of the... shoot out of the mobile emitter.
I was fine with that bit at that stage, but then suddenly it manages to build a Borg maturation chamber out of the console. And then get some DNA and suddenly...
Okay, you're right. That makes less sense. You're absolutely right. When you put it in those terms, yes.
It probably doesn't make a lot of sense, but it probably makes more sense than some other episodes of Star Trek, so I'm not too worried about it. I can let it go. I can kind of just go, okay, fine. That's what they decided to... It works.
It makes more sense to me than, you know, evolving into a salamander.
Well, I was about to say, it makes more sense than thresholds, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But it's kind of weird, because at a certain point, they kind of came up with this idea that nanoprobes do most of the assimilating, because when Captain Picard, back on in Next Generation, was assimilated, it was like they were kind of grafting stuff onto him, and they injected him with a thing to change his skin color, but you didn't see any nanoprobes doing anything assimilation-like, really.
No, but isn't that because they did something different with Picard?
I don't know.
Well, because he ended up still being Locutus and being a separate... thing that he wasn't part of the hive mind in the same way, was he? He was kind of sort of separate, so I think they did that differently.
That, and you're also dealing with 29th century technology.
Right.
As opposed to
that's true.
What they have then, you know. So you never know what the 29th century tech adds to it.
29th century Borg look pretty scary, don't they?
I don't know, he looked pretty buff.
Yeah, but he was fine because he wasn't part of the hive and they managed to kind of educate him more towards their own way of looking at things. But if he'd been, imagine if there was like, you know, 50 of them coming at you and they were all
that would be a little frightening.
That would be scary.
I would have a little anxiety about that.
They could just like transport behind you.
I actually kind of think 29th century Borg have a big issue with personal space. One was in everyone's business. Like, he was like 2 inches from their face.
He was like a toddler.
He didn't quite get that, did he? Yeah,
he was like a toddler.
No boundaries.
Which is exactly what he was.
No boundaries whatsoever.
Just an interesting observation, though, about the way the actor portrayed the role, right? You know, there's every Borg actor puts a unique spin on being a Borg, and he just kind of had this robotic stiffness, and yet he was so eager and excited because he was, you know, an individual, more or less. But he just got right up in people's faces. That's how he played it. I thought it was interesting.
Wasn't he also a Nazi in an episode?
Oh, I don't know.
Because he looked really familiar, but I mean, was all the makeup, and I'm like, he looks like that dude.
There were a couple of things, actually, that he reminded me of. So when he's first kind of like coming out and into the ship and seeing everybody, and he's like going along and he's like, ah, oh, human female. He reminded me of Lal. He reminded us of Lal a little bit.
Yeah.
You know who he reminds me of? I know it's not, but he totally reminds me of Seven of Nine's dad, Borgified.
Maybe.
I'm kind of drawing a blank on that.
Just a resemblance.
Just a resemblance, yeah.
But yeah, just the way he was there, he reminded me of Lal. Human female. She's anxious. That was funny. She's afraid of me. Because I think Lal said something like that at one point. But yeah, he just reminded me of that. And then there was also the bit where he's going, I wish to assimilate more information. That just reminded me of Short Circuit.
Oh, yeah.
Johnny Five going, import, import, import.
Oh, Johnny Five.
Yeah. So it's like a mashup of Lal and Johnny Five is where I was. That's
the best mashup ever.
Actually, so you know, remember? Okay, this is again like we're dropping the old references tonight. That's what we're doing. But you know, remember in Short Circuit when he jumps on the grasshopper and he's like, oh, grasshopper, disassemble.
Yeah,
I can totally picture him going, assimilated. Assimilated.
Now I just have a picture in my head of Johnny Five hopping like a grasshopper when he tries to be the grasshopper.
Yes. But now I'm sad because he squishes him.
Poor
grasshopper. You can't unassimilate him. He's dead.
He is very earnest, isn't he? I think that's probably the one best word to use to describe one. Earnest.
No filter. Yes, no filter. I love the way he's like barking at Seven of Nine to give him his designation. State our designation. State our designation.
Well, that's just like Borg.
Designation is irrelevant.
But it's not even like Borg, it's not like robotic Borg, like it's like angry Borg, like state our designation now, Seven.
Well, I think it's just because
he's barking.
It's like his first thing he's programmed to do, so because I don't think they're programmed to expect somebody not to just tell them it. Borg get cross if they don't get what they want. Angry Borg, boundary issues, anger issues.
They've got issues.
Who knew the Borg were so testy, you know?
Yeah, they have problems.
So I feel like we should, while we're talking about him being a unique Borg, I feel like we should compare this a little bit with iBorg from The Next Generation. Because this is kind of like Voyager's version of iBorg. You know, Borg regains his individuality. It's kind of like Seven of Nine was kind of like that too originally, but this is very parallel to iBorg.
Well, didn't Hugh also want a designation?
Yeah.
He wanted a name.
Well, that's how he ends up being Hugh, isn't it? Because somebody says you at one point, and then he kind of...
Yeah. I'm
trying to Geordi remember, because it's a little while Hugh. Since I've seen that, but yeah. Hugh. Yeah.
And Captain Picard's like, Hugh. Just like Captain Janeway's like, one? Seven of Nine.
Really?
It seemed appropriate. Do you know, when he goes into the ready room with Seven, Janeway is just so pleased with herself, isn't she? She's just like, she's like puffing her chest up like a happy cockerel. She's like, see, I was right.
She's like, look, I made a new individual. Yay.
We created a Borg.
Look, I have saved another waif for my waif menagerie.
Now she was very hesitant on terminating one, yet with Tuvix, she was bam. All up in there.
That's a good point. And what exactly is the difference?
I don't see a difference.
Well, it's because if with Tuvix, it was two other people, whereas with one, it was like it wasn't.
Oh, it's just the doctor's freedom. It's the doctor's freedom.
Yeah, but it's nobody's life, is it?
No, but you just forced Mulcahy to have a kid that he didn't want, which we never see him with.
So you're saying that with Tuvix, it's one versus two, like one person's life versus two people's lives, right?
Yeah.
And here in Drone, it's one person's life versus nothing. Right?
Well, yeah, effectively, because like he's so brilliant, isn't he? And they find that out when they have the whole bit in engineering where he fixes the whole nebula calculation thing that B'Elanna's trying to do. But I kind of figured he would just be able to like make another mobile emitter for the doctor. Wouldn't he?
He'd use his nanoprobes for that.
Yeah.
Right, put some nanoprobes on the job, they'll make the doctor a new mobile emitter.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Lickety split.
Can I have my mobile emitter? Oh, yeah. He never asked, though, did he?
No, he didn't.
If he'd asked him, he'd just been like, oh, yeah, here you go.
Hey, one, can you make me another one of those, please? Yeah. You know, spit in a cup and put those nanoprobes to work.
Spit in a cup?
Nice, Zach, nice. Just chuck a few old bits of circuitry in there, it'll be fine. He'll create a new mobile emitter, no problem at all.
It's like MacGyver. Here's a paperclip and a rubber band. Okay, here's your mobile emitter.
Don't underestimate those nanoprobes.
Never underestimate the nanoprobes.
I think Captain Janeway is in a really unique position here. This is a tough moral dilemma. She's got to balance one's individual rights, because he's an individual, he's a life form, he's got rights like every other individual, right? Mm-hmm. And she's got to balance the overall good of everyone on the ship, right? He's a danger. He could, you know, try to rejoin the collective. He could try to assimilate them. There's some danger with having him on board. And she also has to kind of weigh his future potential. Like, he's a little, he's not a baby, but he's like 2 days old, right? So he's got a lot of future potential, the kind of individual he could be, the contributions he could make. And he's like a 2 day old nascent Borg. Mm-hmm. So she's got to weigh all of that together. And, you know, I think she's proud that she's managed to create it. She's proud of what she did with Seven of Nine. So she's, she wants to repeat that experience and bring another Borg individual into fruition.
But is she proud of herself or how Seven is progressing with him?
Both, I think.
Both.
Yeah.
It's like it's like teaching the teacher. She's taught the teacher.
So does that make her a grandmother, since she's sort of a mother figure to Seven, and now here's one, so she's a grandma? Granny Janeway.
Granny Janeway. Oh.
Yeah, in their off time, you know, I can picture Captain Janeway and One going into Neelix's kitchen like, let's make some jam
together. Let's get some ice cream.
It's an even weirder family than the family in Before and After.
Oh, weird family. Yeah.
Voyager's all about the weird families.
I can't remember the boy's name.
Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew.
One is going to get some good grandma-grandson time together, and they're going to make some Leol root jam in Neelix's kitchen.
Aww.
Would it be jam or jelly or preserves?
Who knows? Who knows?
I don't know what they do in the Delta Quadrant in the 24th century.
It could be all of the above.
You're revealing our pre-podcast conversation.
I'm just bringing things full circle. What people don't realize is that we actually shoot the breeze for like an hour before we actually start recording To the Journey. So we've talked about all kinds of stuff that you guys will never, ever hear.
Oh, and that's sad. They should hear it.
We talked about jam today. For like 20 minutes today. And so I'm bringing it full circle. That's what I'm doing.
Full circle.
Full circle. You need to read
that.
I was
going to say, while we're talking about full circle, Zach, you need to read that.
Oh, yeah. That thing I'm never going to do.
No, you're going to read it so we can talk about
Eventually, you'll get bored.
Oh, yeah, right. That's right. We are actually putting an episode of To the Journey on the calendar to talk about full circle. And I promise by that point, whenever we get around to doing this, when it's on the calendar.
5 years from now.
Like you promised that you'd watch Alien.
Mm-hmm.
One day. I'm a slow mover. I'm not a mover and a shaker. I don't like change.
I'm just going to put these episodes in the calendar and then you'll have to. I understand the whole 29th century drone thing. And as we said before, you know, they're super scary. And if the Borg managed to assimilate him, then potentially they'd become a lot more dangerous. But in a lot of ways, I think they've already got a lot of risk by having Seven on the ship. Because as we see later, the Borg Queen on several occasions tries to use Seven against them, doesn't mm-hmm. she?
Multiple Borg Queens.
They can do some sort of weird telepathic communication, like they're still linked to the hive mind, even though they're separated. I don't really understand how that works, but...
Well, they have a communication thing.
Yeah, because Chakotay had that for a while when he was linked with that Riley person.
You mean they have an interplexing beacon?
Oh, to use the fancy term, sure. Yeah.
Hoity-toity.
Yeah, and Seven disabled it, so he grew a new one.
The doctor gave me a pill and I grew a new kidney.
The doctor gave me a pill, I grew a new interplexing beacon. I grew a new interplexing beacon.
Fully functional.
Well, we learned the Borg reproduce asexually, right? So they can just divide, like it's like cellular division. How does that work exactly, now that you mention it?
Well, they assimilate, don't they? They don't actually reproduce.
Yeah, they just
assimilate.
That's
true, I guess.
Except for in this episode where the nanoprobes plus DNA equals baby.
Plus 29th century tech.
Yeah.
The nanoprobes wanted something a little more exotic this time around.
Yeah.
I'm looking to have some fun.
Exactly. So I want to talk a little bit about one's self-sacrifice. I think this is one of the sweeter parts of the episode, is the fact that he essentially sacrifices himself, not only to save Voyager in the moment, but out of trying to protect Voyager's future security, like protect them against the Borg that could come someday if you remained on the ship.
Yeah.
And Seven echoing her statement from the beginning of when she's first interacting with him, "You're hurting me," but it's used in a different connotation, and that just... Mm. When she says it that second time, and that's when I lose it. Because he's essentially like a child to her. Mm. That's her child.
I think that's how she sees it.
And one is in a slightly different situation than Hugh from that episode of TNG, I, Borg, because one is a 29th century Borg, essentially. So he can't go be reassimilated. He can't rejoin the collective, even as an individual, because he's endangering Voyager if he does that.
Mm. Not just Voyager, the Alpha Quadrant. Beta, Delta, everybody. Everybody's messed up.
To say nothing of the Doctor's mobile emitter, right?
Exactly. You can kiss that emitter goodbye.
You know, the Doctor's like, the whole Borg army, it could be swarming on the Alpha Quadrant. The Doctor would be like, what about my mobile emitter?
Yeah. He would.
He totally would.
Although he is very sweet about it when one says to him, oh, was I unwelcome because I was an accident? And the Doctor says that, well, no, because even though you weren't expected, our mission is to look for new forms of life.
Yeah.
I thought that was nice because I thought, you know, with the emitter situation, he might have been a bit weird about it, but he wasn't.
He's kind of like the kids that were an accident. Like, oh, yeah, we didn't plan on having another one, but it was an accident.
Well, that would be me.
You know, we love you now you're here.
We love you anyway, one. You were an accident, but we love you.
Yeah, we love you anyway. But the thing I really like about that is about how he sacrifices himself is that he kind of... I don't think Seven realizes the moment when she kind of gives him that idea, because it's the bit where she says, oh... Well, he asks her, do you wish to rejoin the collective? And she says, Voyager is my collective. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment when it twigs in his head. You see it kind of... And obviously Janeway has a moment as well.
Yeah.
I don't mean to disregard what you're saying, but I'm still totally stuck on the accident thing. I kind of picture like Bob Ross painting his happy little trees. Like, there's no such thing as mistakes, when there's just happy accidents.
Oh, when he gets a little blob of paint on
happy
there.
Accident.
Yeah. Make this happy tree.
Happy little interplexing happy beacons.
And happy cloud. Yeah.
Happy little Borg spheres.
With a little smiley face. But yeah, I think he just ends up seeing Voyager as his collective the same way that Seven does. And that's when he's prepared to do whatever it takes to protect them.
I think if there's a moment that makes me kind of tear up, again, I don't really cry in Voyager, but if I were going to, I would cry over Seven of Nine saying, Voyager's my collective.
To me, that's just an aww moment. Aww.
It's so sweet, right?
The bit that gets me is the part bit of the where... family. He's crying when Seven's trying to persuade him to put down the force field and let the Doctor treat him. And then the act is so incredible. Like, he starts getting really emotional and like, oh, that's a great moment. Gets me.
Well, Chakotay actually has a really good moment in this episode. And it's not even the Harry Kim stuff. It's just when one hears the collective and then Seven's like, I hear them too. The look on his face, he's like, oh, crap. It just got real. Yeah. Just like, oh.
It's going to hit the fan.
Yeah.
And just the look on his face, it was great. I was like, yeah, Chakotay.
A moment, yeah.
Remember the bit at the beginning of the episode, towards the beginning, when one kind of comes out of the maturation chamber and Seven of Nine has to interface with him? Mm-hmm. Tuvok makes no sense whatsoever. He's like, are you sure this is a good idea? She's like, oh, it's okay, Tuvok. He's like, oh, well then, okay, by all means, go ahead.
He just didn't want to argue. He was tired.
He didn't take much convincing. Yeah.
He's like, whatever, you're going to do what you want to do anyway.
And as long as 7 of 9 says it's okay, life is good.
But I think everybody gets some nice little moments in this episode, actually. I really like the bit in the corridor where he's talking to Neelix, and Neelix is like, well, I look a bit weird with my whiskers and spots.
But were people afraid of you?
And there are lots of little chuckaway bits in this episode that are quite nice. We've already talked about the Doctor's funny moments, but I really like the fact that this episode is the origin of the idea for the Delta Flyer,
yes.
Even though they don't really talk about it very much.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we forget that, yes, we know it's going to be the Delta Flyer now, but at that time we didn't know it was going to become the Delta Flyer.
And it was just a throwaway line at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why don't you design your own? Yeah.
That only becomes a thing watching it in retrospect. Like, you would never have taken anything from that the first time of seeing it.
Yeah, it would have just gone in one ear, out the other. Yeah. Just random dialogue.
Now you rewatch it and you're like, oh, mm-hmm. The seed has been planted. Tom's going to build a hot rod.
I feel like this is one of these things I should know as a Voyager fan and as co-host of To the Journey, but I don't. Like, how close was this when the Delta Flyer came out? Like, is this
I don't think it's long after this when they start doing it.
Yeah, because weren't they building it in Extreme Risk, which is the next episode?
Yeah, right. Exactly. So they were just setting up the next episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at the time, you would never think of it.
Yeah.
But it is nice.
But it's funny how we read those things in there. Like, we know it's a Delta Flyer, and mm-hmm. that's what we hear when we hear that line. But at the time, it was just, no, it's just a line.
Yeah, but it is nice, because that's the kind of thing where you wouldn't necessarily, when you were then watching the... Like, I don't think when you're watching the next episode, you'd remember that she said that. So it's just there for people that are going to go back and watch it later. That's what I like about it.
That tiny continuity bit right there.
Yeah.
Who says Voyager has no continuity?
Ah.
It has loads. We did a whole episode about that ages ago.
Yeah, but we just found another instance. So there you go.
Yeah, that's true. There are loads of bits of continuity all over the place.
So a second ago, we mentioned the Harry Kim moment, which is I find that truly amusing, and I just get a full belly laugh every time I hear that. Every time Chakotay says, I hear you make them call you Captain. That just cracks
Captain
me up
Kim.
Every time.
It is funny. And then the bit he says afterwards, isn't it, when he asks him to go do something, and then he says, if you're all right with going back to being an ensign.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I can totally picture this happening like as a joke. Like, Harry Kim's sitting in the big chair, and he says, okay, you know, set course to blah, 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 and engage. And someone says, aye, sir, to Harry Kim, and he says, that's Captain Kim to you. And I could picture him saying that as a joke.
If Tom was on that shift with him, it would have been, you got it, Captain Kim.
Whatever, Captain Kim.
Well, sarcastic. Yeah. Those kind of moments are great, because that's a Voyager moment. Like, that wouldn't happen on any of the other shows.
No.
Not like that. That's a Voyager moment, that is. That's the whole, oh, we're colleagues, but we're also family.
Yeah.
Like, there's this, it's,
and we'll give each other a hard time all the time.
It's one of the things that creates the Voyager feel for me, those types of things.
You know, Harry is loving being in the center chair. He's like, I got to do a sensor analysis. This was great.
Yeah.
I'm in charge.
I think he thought that getting promoted worked like a video game, and if he spends enough time on the night shift sitting in the captain's chair, he'll eventually level up.
Put in enough hours and I got this.
You know, where it's like, I don't know, World of Warcraft or something, and you can level up by either going on a really, you know, flashy mission and suddenly leveling up, or just grinding for hours and hours and hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's Harry grinding for XP right there. It never worked for him, but you know.
Harry Kim grinding for XP. Like, World of Warcraft is like...
Yes.
Okay.
He's like, every night he's just racking up a little bit more, but he only managed to get about halfway up the bar before he got back to the Alpha Quadrant.
See, I was kind of picturing him, like, dressed up as Mario or Luigi trying to get the one up.
He'd be Luigi. He couldn't be Mario.
He'd knock himself out headbutting boxes, surely. He'd be like, doof, ow, doof, ow, doof, dunk. And then he'd be on the floor with, like, birds going around his head.
It's actually really weird that he gets to be in charge. He's still an ensign. Like, there's, like, 40 other people on the ship who are, you know, higher ranking than he is, who could be more qualified as a bridge officer.
They didn't want to pull night shift.
The rest of them like sleep.
Mm-hmm. They're like, I want to hang out with everybody else. I don't want to be on night shift.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's so keen, they just let him do it. They're like, yeah, you do it, because it's a crappy shift nobody wants to do.
You know, B'Elanna would be like, I don't want to be in command. I just want to sleep in.
B'Elanna would not want to be in charge, I don't think. She doesn't strike me as the kind of person that likes being in charge.
That would take her away from her engines anyway. She wouldn't do that.
Exactly.
How cool would it be to be in charge of the night shift? That would be awesome on a starship. Imagine the conversations and the... It's not quite a party. I would have so much fun.
You'd fall asleep.
I would take the night shift in a heartbeat.
No,
but
thanks.
You would fall asleep, though.
No. You could tell some jokes. You could run some sensor sweeps. Whatever. It'd be cool.
Do you think Harry falls asleep?
When he's not composing music on his clarinet.
And he's got a little alarm. He's got like his Apple Watch, but his alarm is like a vibrate instead of a noise. And like just about 2 minutes before Chakotay's due to come on the bridge, he's like, bzzz, and he's like, oh, I was awake all night, honest.
He goes into the ready room and takes a nap on the couch.
Yeah.
Actually, we know that Harry likes to play clarinet on the bridge.
Isn't that like against regulations or something?
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. You can get away with that on the night shift.
I think that's the least of the things that is against regulations.
I know, but if I'm the science officer on the night shift, I would be reporting that right away. I'd be like, he won't stop with a freaking clarinet, and it's annoying.
You would be a science officer tattletale?
Yes, I would, because it's Harry Kim.
Harry Kim gets to play clarinet on the bridge. How come I don't get to do blah, 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 blah?
Why can't I play my cymbals on the bridge? You know, where do you draw the line?
I want to play my triangle, darn it.
I want to play my bugle.
No, somebody with a recorder. Or a pan flute.
Thinking back to the original series, like, I can picture Spock kind of like harboring this deep-seated resentment he doesn't get to play his Vulcan lyre on the bridge.
His lute. I don't get to play my lute on the bridge.
I just think it would be neat. Like, if I were, you know, a junior officer on a ship and they put me in charge of the entire ship for a few hours at night, that's cool.
Yeah.
I just think it's a neat idea. That's all. I don't have any deep thoughts about it.
He's super keen on doing it, isn't he?
I'd rather have my shift when the captain is, you know, on shift. Because that's when all the exciting stuff happens.
Yeah. Why is that exactly?
Why, though?
This makes no sense. Okay, yes, I'm glad we're talking about this.
How do all of the aliens and, like, anomalies and everything know to only happen during the daytime? That's what I want to know.
Between the hours of 8 and 5. That's when...
I want to see an episode where Harry's on the bridge and something happens and then Janeway's up on the bridge in her rollers, like...
in her room.
No, really, this is a serious question. Do you think that back in the Alpha Quadrant, forget the Delta Quadrant for a minute, do you think that back in the Alpha Quadrant, the different alien races, the different empires, have synced up their time zones?
Well, there'd be Federation standard time, I assume. Because I'm assuming that's what the ships operate on.
Yeah.
So Harry's shift begins at, like, 1900 hours FDT, Federation... daylight time.
Daylight savings
time? They're not going to have daylight savings time in space, Zach. I don't think they need that.
Well, if you show up late, an hour late for your shift, you can blame it on that, right?
Oh, so. I slept in. Sorry. No. forgot to reset.
But
the
I assume that all the Federation ships operate on like a standard time, which I guess is Earth time because that's where headquarters is. But
this is really weird. Why are the Vidians respecting Federation time? This makes no sense.
They don't.
I mean, and what happens? Like, okay, so suppose you're in command of the night shift. Boom. And then the Vidians show up. Boom. What do you do? What's the protocol? Do you...
Red alert, captain of the bridge.
Message? Red alert, captain of the bridge.
Which is exactly what Chakotay did.
Yeah. And then Janeway's up there in a little pink negligee. Chakotay's up in his PJs.
No. You're making light of this. This is a serious question. Like, how serious does it have to be to justify waking the captain up at night?
It has to be, like, the Borg. Or, you know, they're being boarded.
Take it down a notch. Like, not the Borg, but, like, suppose a Vidian ship shows up. Boom. What do you do?
I would call Tuvok first.
You use the
Follow
hierarchy.
The chain
you
of
use
command.
The chain of command.
Security.
Well, and also, because Vulcans don't, like, sleep, do they? They just meditate for, like, 4 hours or something.
He's probably messing with his Kalto, so, you know, he's awake.
That's what I imagine. I don't think they need to sleep very much. I think they kind of meditate for some hours. And I'm sure he says that at some point. I'm sure he says something about meditating instead of sleep. But anyway, I could be wrong. I could be thinking about D&D elves. Who knows?
Yes, because it's easy to confuse them with Vulcans.
It is, actually. It's surprisingly easy.
No, I just want to get this straight. So Ensign Kim, there's an emergency. There's like a ship that, you know, shows up out of nowhere. It's a potentially dangerous situation. And he doesn't say, red alert, captain of the bridge. He says, get me Tuvok on subspace right now.
No, he would just tap his communicator, Tuvok. Say, Ensign Kim to Tuvok.
You know when, like, you have little kids and you have, like, a guideline, house rules on the wall? Harry's got one of those. If this happens, call Tuvok. If this happens, call Janeway.
It's a table. So, like, is this an emergency? Yes. And it tells you what to do? No.
Check yes or no.
It's a flow chart. He's got a flowchart.
There you go.
Is it the Borg? Yes. Call the captain. Is it not the Borg? No. Okay. Is it the Vidians?
Is it this? Is it that?
Is it Seska?
Right,
yes.
Exactly.
Do not call Chakotay.
don't wake Blonde up no matter what you do.
Oh, no. I had a thought. And this is way, way off topic. Because I was watching it the other day.
Because we never do that.
Way off topic. So Seska steals Chakotay's DNA, right?
Yeah.
And says she impregnates herself with his DNA, which we find out, no, it's not his baby. But still, he thinks it's his baby. So, yes, we are going to chase the baby down. We chase after this baby, yet when Paris and Janeway have actual salamander babies, we leave them on the planet. What is with that?
Because they're not human.
So what? That's still their children.
I know. I agree with you.
In this DNA stealing baby making scenario.
Which is not how I got pregnant. Thank you.
Oh my God, it's Chakotay's.
Chakotay, you're going to have to come to the bridge for this one.
Red alert.
There's another woman here saying this is your baby, sir.
You got some splaining to do.
Yeah. But in all genuine seriousness, if any of our listeners want to create a flowchart of Harry's flowchart on the bridge,
please do so. That would be awesome.
Please do so. We would love you forever. We need to have Harry's bridge shift flowchart. That needs to be a thing that exists.
That actually sounds like a great task for Aaron Harvey.
Because he doesn't have enough to do.
The Harry Kim night shift command decision flowchart.
And there could be a fanfic that goes along with that.
There's always a fanfic that goes along with everything.
How the flowchart came to be.
Well, it's not totally clear. Like, okay, if you're in command, these are serious questions. Like, if you're in command of the night shift, how much of the captain's authority do you have? Are you essentially acting captain? Can you do pretty much anything you want to do? Can you fire those phasers? Can you shoot the photon torpedoes? Can you order ramming speed and you know, ram the ship into something? Like, what is the range of things you can do in command of the
ship? So, in all seriousness, you know, we are joking slightly about a flowchart, but I actually genuinely do think there probably is a set of guidelines of what you can and can't do.
No self-destruct.
Yeah. I don't know exactly. Don't press the big red button, Harry.
Exactly. No ordering self-destruct on the night shift.
Well, he can't do that by himself anyway, can he? Because they have
But he can do it with another officer, right? He could say, hey, you know, and
well, Janeway only has to do one.
But maybe he can't, because maybe it needs more senior people. Like, maybe it's only Janeway and Chakotay that can do it.
Again, these are just things that don't make sense. Like, what if all the senior staff were incapacitated and some junior officer, two junior officers, or three, however many it takes to blow up a ship, need to blow up the ship, and they can't?
How many junior officers does it take to blow up a ship?
That's exactly my question.
That sounds like a really bad joke.
Where do you draw the line, and what do you do if you need to blow up the ship and all the senior staff are incapacitated? What would Ensign Kim do if he had to blow up the damn ship?
Well, I think if all the senior staff are incapacitated, then...
He's SOL.
So it would be WWEKD.
But then, isn't there like a command code transference policy thing? Like, don't people have the command codes at certain times and they transfer them if they need to?
Yeah, because didn't the doctor have it at some point?
Yeah.
The emergency command hologram. That's it. ECH. You just summon the emergency command hologram.
Yeah.
Activate ECH and blow up the ship.
So I guess it would depend on whether they transferred him the command codes or not.
I would never give Harry the command codes.
Me neither.
Every time you take command of the night shift, do you ipso facto inherit the command codes?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I don't think he's got anywhere near as much responsibility as the captain. I think he can probably do... He can handle some fairly basic situations, but I think if anything happens that's in any way threatening to the ship, he wakes up Janeway.
Yeah. Away.
So I'm actually thinking back, way back in the day, there was an episode of the West... I think it was the West Wing, and the president was having an operation done, and what happens in that situation, apparently the Speaker of the House gets to take over his role. I forget, like, maybe there was no vice president. Like,
I was going to say, it would go to the vice, and if there's no vice, then it'd go to Speaker.
I think that's the situation I'm describing. So the Speaker of the House, who is like third in line as president, like not the president, not the vice president, the third one down, like he gets to be acting president, and he gets the nuclear command codes. Because he's now the acting president. Is Harry Kim essentially the acting captain with the 24th century equivalent of the nuclear command codes?
Heck no. Would you trust Harry Kim with that? Would anybody trust Harry Kim with that?
I would trust Harry with my life.
You are a crazy man. crazy man.
I was going to say you're a dead man, but
that too, a dead crazy man.
I don't know. Harry does okay in the night shift twice a week.
He'd just leave you to die while he was sleeping with the alien of the week.
Exactly.
Catching some kind of weird space cooties.
Space cooties.
You really don't think that whoever is in command of the ship and the night shift has to be fully empowered to deal with whatever situation unfolds?
No.
No, I don't think so.
We never really find out the answer to this question. This is a hypothetical scenario.
I don't see Harry having like the same authority as Janeway when he's on the night shift. I see him as just being there so she can sleep.
If that was the case, Janeway would be sleeping on the bridge.
Okay, let's just run a couple hypotheticals here. So could Harry Kim order Tuvok? Okay, Tuvok wouldn't be there because Tuvok would be sleeping.
Because then he'd be in then charge. He'd be in charge.
Harry Kim could order whoever the tactical officer is.
Naomi Wildman.
Yes, he could order Captain's assistant Naomi Wildman to fire the photon torpedoes.
I would trust her with the command codes before Harry.
See, at this point, I'm starting to wonder whether or not Harry is really in charge of the bridge at night, or whether they have a holodeck simulation of the bridge and they're just letting him think he's in charge.
It's like Moriarty.
Okay, you guys always make fun of me for not reading Star Trek books, but there's a Star Trek novel I read way back in the day called Boogeymen, where they essentially do that. They sort of train people to... Have you read it, Kay? It's a great novel.
Oh, quite a while back, yes. Not recently.
It's great. But remember, Wesley is taking... He's like taking the bridge officer's test or training to be a bridge officer in the holodeck. And then they get stuck in the holodeck and they think they're on the... You know, it's a great book. You should read it. But maybe that's what happened. Harry Kim is not really in charge of the night shift. He's just on the holodeck.
I would believe that.
Hashtag headcanon.
See, my intuitions go the other way. I feel like if you're really going to be in charge, in command, you have to have some authority to deal with things. I think they would trust Harry Kim with the photon torpedoes. That's what I think.
We don't really know, do we? So it's just speculation.
No, I mean, this is fun. This is what we do.
I personally wouldn't trust Harry with the photon torpedoes, but...
No, really?
Never. Never, 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 never.
Are you guys serious? Are you guys? I mean,
no, I'm serious.
You wouldn't. I could see you guys joking like this, but I...
No, I'm serious.
I would hand over the keys.
I wouldn't even put him in charge of the galley. I wouldn't know.
You guys are so mean to Harry. What did he do to you?
I didn't hate him. I just think he's calamity follows him, is my feeling with Harry.
Why would Captain Janeway put him in charge of the night shift if that's how people view Harry?
Because it's a rubbish job and nobody else wants to do it.
And it gets him off her shift, so she doesn't have to deal with him.
Which is weird because he is on her shift whenever we see him, so when does he sleep? But let's not go into that.
Somebody's got to pull a double shift and Harry's dumb enough to do it. There we go.
Well, to change topic slightly.
Yes, please.
And this is going to get a bit theoretical, so stick with me. But something that really kind of struck me about this episode this time I watched it, which I hadn't really noticed previous occasions, is obviously we get Seven looking into the mirror at the beginning and she's smiling, and then at the end we get her looking into the mirror and she's not smiling. But I kind of got this weird sense this time that I watched it that at the end when she's looking into the mirror, she gets this whole feeling of the fact that watching Wan's development and seeing him kind of is a mirror of herself. I felt like they were trying to do something with that and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but I got a sense of that this time that I was watching it. I thought, oh, are they saying that like she sees herself at the end and she's looking at herself and thinking, I've just kind of seen me and I don't feel like I'm as good as he is. He did better than I have.
Seeing her own shortcomings. Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt that too.
Or could you read it the other way? Or could she be thinking about how far she's actually come now that she's seen the development of someone else?
That is an optimistic way to look at it.
When you see her at the end, like when you see that reflection, there's obviously a lot going on in there emotionally and like just her mental thought processes. And I think there's an element of seeing how far she's come, but also kind of questioning if she would do the same thing. Would I be capable of doing that?
Yeah.
If I would be, what does that say about me? If I wouldn't be, what does that say about me? You know, did he do better than I have and stuff? That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah.
I don't know. There felt like there was a lot going on with her at the end there.
Like maybe it's selfish for her to stay on the ship when she is, again, kind of ipso facto being there, endangering Voyager by being there. Is that what you're saying?
But she doesn't endanger Voyager as much because she doesn't have the 29th century tech.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I had a question. She shuts down one's alcove at the end. But the alcove just to the right of that is still on. And her alcove was to the left of his. Why is that other one on?
What's the point of unplugging the alcove?
I don't know, but still, you shut symbolic. It down. Why is the other one still on? Nobody was using that.
I don't know.
So it's just draining power for no reason.
Good to have a backup, yeah.
Why were they even on when they had to switch them on?
Yeah.
Because earlier when they went to regenerate, they had to switch them on. So why were they still switched on?
Yeah, it's just draining power.
You know that Tom Paris is like, come on, Seven, will you turn off your alcove so I can have a few more replicator rations? Come on.
So I can watch my TV.
you'd think it would be like a modern TV, you know. We're in the 24th century here. Mm-hmm. You get this little message coming up. It has been a while since you've used your alcove. It will hibernate in 10 seconds.
Or Netflix asking if you're still there.
Kate, no. These are 24th century Energy Star alcoves. They're okay. They're LEDs now.
Right, okay.
But they're still vampire electronics. Low power. Sucking up the juice.
But presumably they still auto-sleep after a while if you're not using them.
So the alcove auto-sleeps, and then when 7 of 9 needs to sleep, the auto-alcove wakes up?
Does it make that okay. Windows noise when it comes up? Oh.
I have to thank you, Suzanne, for introducing into my headcanon, my own personal headcanon now, that every time 7 of 9 goes into Rocco, you get...
This is actually a really well-written episode when you start delving into it.
That's the thing. I didn't used to grasp how brilliant the dialogue was in this episode, and it is really, really well written. I totally appreciate that now.
Mm-hmm.
I still find One kind of boring. He doesn't really do much for me as a character. I don't cry when he dies. I'm not one of those.
It's because you're heartless.
When one dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not like Suzanne in this regard, but.
I cry too.
See, you're heartless.
But I think the episode is really well crafted and it's a brilliant episode. I just don't particularly care for One all that much.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get to see too much of his individual personality. We get to see a little bit, but not massive.
Every time I say these things, I get hate mail. I'm sorry.
Well, no, because I watched it with Timothy tonight, and he was like, oh, I hope One doesn't die. I really like him, so...
Like, nope, he's like a red shirt. He's
I know,
finished.
And anytime Timothy likes a character, it's the kiss of death. No matter what show we're watching, if he likes the character, boom, they die.
No, that's a great... He's kind of like the red shirt Borg. He is toast. There's no chance he's making it out of this episode.
Don't let him watch Discovery.
Oh, I know. Well, he's been watching Discovery with me. So I know he's going to like somebody and they're just going to die.
Don't let him kill anyone.
Oh, he's coming in.
Everybody's got to have a skill.
We were just podcast bombed. Wow.
We were.
But then weren't we planning to go crash Earl Grey after we've recorded this?
We were planning to podcast bomb somebody else, so.
Because they are recording at the same time as us tonight. So.
Full circle.
Which is a book you should read, Zachary.
That's why I said it, yes!
Way to bring it full circle, Kay.
Ba-dow-bow.
And that is the beautiful poetry of this episode of To the Journey.
Well, on that note, it's been fun talking about Drone, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
Is there anything else we need to add, or do we think that's the...
Are we going to cure Riker, or...
Oh, shoot, I forgot about Riker. Yeah, sure, fine, we'll keep him around.
Yeah, we've cured Riker. And then for me, this would, yeah, or not.
Meta Treks.
Troy's quarters, Data's quarters.
They're very Spartan.
They're very Spartan.
In fact, Data's girlfriend even says they're Spartan.
Yes, yes. And so what does she do? She brings him stuff.
A trinket to fill it up.
To fill it up.
Warp 5.
And this reminds me so much of the cage. So much of the cage.
See, I think of... you think of the cage too, but I also think of... what's his name? Baylock in the Corbomite maneuver,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Offering him the drink.
Tranya.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
For an opening episode to get that relationship, like you could see that crew really had been working together for 7 years, which is so not normal for a launch, for a first episode, right? Because you've got the odds, but they seemed to have working forever together. The camaraderie that they had, the trust that they have with each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners-only group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek.fm show and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find us on Twitter at Trek.fm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trek.fm. Kay, when you're not grinding for XP, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference. And if you want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is ChocoWeeble. So, Zach, when you're not assimilating information, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of MetaTrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can always find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Voyager with me over there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Suzanne? When you're not busy playing with fire, waking up a sleeping Klingon, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, I'm not silly enough to do that, Zach. But you can find me in the Babel Conference every now and again. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is KJaneway8.
Now, come on, Suzanne. I know you like to live dangerously.
Not that dangerously. Whew, that's just asking for trouble.
Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, and we really, really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, there are some people we would like to thank this evening. First and foremost would be the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, who also has the designation 1 in our collective, C. Brian Jones. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Brandon Shematala, our Patreon manager. And a special shout out to our associate producers, who keep To the Journey coming to you each and every week. Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carlin, and Norman Lau. Thank you very much.
Well, be sure to join us next week when we will be building the Delta Flyer. But until then, this has been To the Journey.